Hey, Sefer Chinuch, Mitzvot 341 to 342 and 343 hopefully we'll get to, and it's the 12th of the year, April 22nd, 2013. Okay, 341, the precept of redeeming heritage land in a walled city within a year. That the redemption of landed heritage properties within a city that is walled about should be allowed until the completion of 1 year. So we talked about that last year.
Last week,
yes, thank you. I'm looking at the word year. Thank you. We talked about last week that if you own property within a walled city, and we weren't sure, I'm not sure how it applies.
I was just going to say.
Yes, to the old city of Jerusalem. And it's interesting because one of the things I flagged just to mention here, so I'll say it to you guys too, if anybody can find out, that'd be great. He's discussing different things here on page 429. The second to the last paragraph, it's the same mitzvah, but where he says, however, I do not know how much the minimal amount of this change, should be for him to become punishable. Grow wise, my son, and find it out. So I think that's just an interesting. I wanted to just point that out, how he tells his son
to go check
something out. Yeah.
Go look it up on the internet.
Figure it out. Yeah.
Well, in the Middle Ages, and well,
how would he
I'm
find
certainly
it out?
By, well, but I was going to, no, I was going back to the walled city. At the time that this was written, most cities had walls around
this
them.
This is not
did
talking
not?
About that. No, no. This is talking specifically about the in Eretz Israel, the land of Eretz Israel, walled
well, were there
cities
any walled
Israel.
Cities other than Jerusalem?
Jericho.
Okay, right.
And I think it's Tzfat, and maybe Tiberia.
Akko, no?
And I don't know about Akko at the time, at biblical times.
Yeah.
There certainly were other walled cities, but in biblical times.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, but
so for sure, Jericho and Jerusalem were walled in biblical times, and maybe Tzfat and Tiberia, but I'm not sure about them.
Is there any part of the wall left in Tzfat? I don't remember.
It doesn't matter if there's a wall left.
No. But I'm saying I don't remember. I don't
think
of it.
Okay,
I think there is. That's interesting.
And
okay.
Yeah, and I'm not sure because we have. Halachas today, and which I just don't know where they apply, but that we would definitely know today, the halacha for Purim and Shushan Purim. Right, so Shushan Purim is celebrated in any area that was walled at the time of the Purim story.
Okay.
Which is a little after biblical times, really.
Right, but still probably still carried
still
over.
Still in between the two temples. Yeah. So outside of Jerusalem is regular Purim, and inside Jerusalem is Shushan Purim. Same thing with Jericho. There's not really Jews in Jericho. And it would apply. So the Jews of Israel would know, because they'd know which Purim they celebrate.
Right.
So it'd be interesting just to know which cities were walled at the time or not. But this has to do, and I think this would also have to do with Levitical cities. This is definitely has to do with Levitical cities that were walled at the time, even if we don't have those cities today. This is talking about that. That when the land was apportioned and people had their heritage places, could you sell it or can't you sell it? So you can only lease your land, a field, until the Yovel, right? So we saw that. But a home inside a walled city, you can sell. But because it's such a tsar to sell it, because it would cause you so much pain, the only reason why you're selling it is if you've fallen on terrible financial times.
Right.
So you do have the year to redeem it, and the person doesn't get the choice, the person that you sold it to. If you get enough money together to buy it back, they have to sell it back to you.
But this obviously doesn't apply now.
So it does not apply now?
Right.
No. So we'll see where it does apply, because he always says that too. But anyway, this is the mitzvah of redeeming heritage land in a walled city within a year. So
so it's a good thing to get it back if you can.
Right. So here, the 340 was to return the land to its owner at the Jubilee. This is that you should redeem if you can. If you can get the money together, you can redeem it, and the person doesn't have a choice. I think we did a mitzvah about a city where if the person tries to get out of giving it back, right?
Yeah, I remember mentioning something about
it
that.
It says here, on account of the preciousness of
the
land.
Right, on account of the precious.
Right. So on account of the preciousness of the land. So you see, that's why the song came up. on account of the preciousness of the land. Right? So because the land is precious, because you for sure want it, because you would never sell it. That's how precious
unless
it is.
Unless you absolutely
you'd
had to.
You'd never sell it unless you have to. So there is provision made for you to be able to buy it back. And even if you die, your son can buy it back within the year. And even if the person who bought it dies, you can still buy it back from their son within the year, or daughter, because it applies to men and women. Right, so that's that law. It's in force. So the end of it, it's in force in the land of Israel for both man and woman at the time that the law of the Jubilee is in effect. So So that's not yet today. This does not apply today, even though we do have the land of Israel, but the Jubilee is not yet in effect. But when it is, this will be.
So it's pretty limited.
Right, it's limited, but it's just, right, so right now it's conceptual to understand the concept of the value of the land of Israel and how we treat people in buying and selling and how we treat property as a concept, real property, that we care for it very much.
Okay, wait, excuse me. There is Jubilee and there's Shemitah, you know, in Israel itself, right? But this is like the ultimate Jubilee?
This is the Jubilee of 70, but of 50, but I don't think that we observe it. It doesn't apply fully today. Land doesn't go back. We don't know who owns
the
land.
But it's
tribally.
Still celebrated, though, isn't it, by the Haredi?
Well,
they do celebrate
Shemitah for sure. We talked about Jubilee last year, remember?
Unfortunately,
we talked about that last time.
Okay,
somebody looked it up.
It hasn't been in our
right.
In my conscience.
We talked about.
Okay. So we don't.
Somebody
know.
Looked it up, and
somebody
we don't know.
You looked it up on your phone.
Right.
It's 2014.
So it's coming up.
15.
Okay.
It's 16.
Coming up.
I thought it was 16, but
okay. It's coming up, but we don't know yet. Okay. So with that, I want to show you. Where did my other book go? Okay. So
that is a team.
Here's for literacy purposes. Okay. So Shimshon Raphael Hirsch wrote Sefer Choriv, right? So this was written in the 1830s, 40s, something like that. And it was written basically to the type of Jew today that we'd call young professionals. You know, those who feel like they're Jewish, they belong to Federation, but they don't do much, and they don't really see why they should do much. So there was that type of Jew at the time, because reform was big. And
hello.
Hello. Welcome. You're so on time for all the juicy stuff. Anyway, so this book was written for that young professional Jew to try to explain why Judaism is relevant and meaningful and what it's all about. It's in difficult language. It was written in German, and to read it today, even translated into English, it's a slog through. But it is a book of good philosophy and very worthwhile.
And historically significant.
And historically significant, absolutely. The much easier way to access the information is in this book. This is Master Plan by Aryeh Carmel. This is a digest and update of this book.
Oh.
So he based it on this book. But it's a digest and update. I love this book, Master Plan, because this is what I would call a forest book, not a trees book. Right? So it
big
gives
picture.
You the whole big picture. That's why it's called Master Plan. Judaism, it's program, meanings, and goals. Right? So it's really not, it's not about how to keep the Torah, but what's the whole thing integrated about? So from here, I do want to read you a section. Do you find it dense?
I do.
It's not a cover-to-cover read.
No.
It's
not,
but you'll see that it's not so bad. So I'm going to read
you. And the print is very little.
Well, it comes bigger. This is the pocket version.
I see. So you can carry it with you always.
You can if you want to. Right. And I might even take it with me because it's so worth it to read again and again. But I want to read you this part about building up Eretz Yisrael as a prelude to the next mitzvah that we're going to see. The next mitzvah being not to alter the open land around the Levites' cities or their fields. So first I'm going to show you the picture, and then I'm going to read you the text. So here's a nice picture. Here's a Levitical city around which there is, can't read upside down with my eyes crossed, amenity parkland. It's 1,000 cubits of migrash, so it's green space. Required 1,000 cubit green space between the city and the vineyard fields, which are also required. So that's why I put a 1, 2, 3 on your sheets for the next mitzvah. These are the three spaces that cannot be altered according to this mitzvah that we're going to learn. The city, the green space, the green belt surrounding it, and then the agricultural belt surrounding that that's set aside for vineyards and orchards. This has to be maintained just the way it is. You're not permitted to change it. So and that's the mitzvah, but let's first look up. I just want to read to you what he said, what Aryeh Carmel says as a digest, and also you'll hear the update. It's interesting. So first of all, land for the Torah. So just a concept. God gave the Torah to a nation, not to an individual or individuals. And that nation was to live in a specially selected land where they were to develop a Torah civilization, a just and caring society, which would be the wonder of the world, right? So this is where I mean, this is Hirschian philosophy. I read this book several times. This is where I get my world view, and this is Torah. In this land, all aspects of the national life were to be transformed and sanctified by the commandments of the Torah, the government, the judiciary, the police, and the army, the agriculture, the commerce, and industry. We've already seen that only an intense spiritual commitment can ensure that social relationships will reach a stable level of justice and love. In most countries, the laws in force were largely designed to protect the vested interests of the powerful landowners. In such a state, any movement to improve the laws would have had little chance of success. It would have been seen as a threat to the interest of the rulers and forcibly suppressed. In an ideal social system could only be established by a nation whose members were imbued with a determination to set up such a system and who saw it as a task bestowed upon them by God, the source of all justice and love. This was to be the overriding national commitment. The practical and symbolical holiness mitzvot, as we shall see, are designed to keep this commitment always at the highest possible level. All facets of life are thus intertwined and work together towards one supreme goal. The land selected was strategically situated for propagating the message of this ideal state. At the junction of three great continents, and with a coastline to the sea to ensure that the message could spread still further afield, Israel is to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Priests? No, not religious functionaries. They were to be agriculturalists, businessmen, professionals. But the way they ran their state and their commerce was to be exemplary. They were to be priests in the sense that they would represent the Spirit of God in the world in practice. And a holy nation. Holy? Does that sound to you cold, withdrawn, otherworldly? This would be a great mistake. Holy, in the Torah sense, means dedicated. Dedicated to justice, integrity, and giving. We have to create an environment in which the Torah can flourish. So now he goes, and I won't read this inside, unless you want to hear it inside. Tell me if I should tell you outside or inside. What's your vote? Yeah, and so, just tell you.
Sure.
So now he goes into a whole this whole page about how it's not working right now. You know, we don't have the land of Israel, and even when we did, we didn't quite achieve that ideal. But now we have the chance again to, and we've tried to live the Torah commitment outside the land of Israel, but now we have the chance again, because he's writing in the 90s.
I was going to ask when he wrote this.
He's writing
okay.
in the 90s, right? We've largely been able to mold a Jewish society outside of the land of Israel, but there's really no hope of its fulfilling its true function outside the land of Israel. Because it has to be a society, not just people and not just communities keeping Torah, but it has to be a whole national society that creates this synergy that allows the world to see us and see how we function so that we can actually serve the purpose of being a light unto the nations. All right, so we can do it in little pieces, but not completely outside.
Still seem pretty far from that.
Yeah. Because, but in Eretz Israel, too, we face an alien environment. So many, through factors beyond their control, have become estranged from the Torah vision. But there's one great difference. The situation in Eretz Israel is one which may well be within our power to change. Maybe if more of us worldwide were to understand the challenge a Jewish Eretz Israel presents to us, we could change the face of this land. And maybe, if one succeeded in this tremendous task, our enemy's hostility might eventually change to grudging respect. Who knows?
Who knows? Who knows?
We'll see. We are privileged to live in an age of the breaking of ideals, of idols. Ideologies such as communism, which held the bodies and souls of hundreds of millions of human beings in an iron grip for generations, have been overthrown. This is a challenge to us to replace them by ideals which have an incomparably sounder basis and have stood the test of time. So now this I'll read to you inside too, because the Torah is, so here's Torah, town planning in the Torah. The Torah is also concerned with the beauty and amenity of Eretz Israel, the land of the Torah environment. The sages of the Torah stress the importance of cleanliness, beauty, and naturalness of environment for a balanced development of the Torah personality. So this is all, think about this, this is all a prerequisite for the balanced development of a Torah personality.
Well, your surroundings
right.
so affect.
It's very interesting just to think about it. I mean, in the Kiruv world, so many people are focused on helping people become Shomer Shabbos. And I'm really working with them to see that Shmirat Shabbat is not a destination, but a prerequisite. Right, that you have to be Shomer Shabbos in order to be the exemplary Jew. But that's not being an exempt. Being Shomer Shabbos and Shomer Kashrus and even keeping the laws of money and all that, and language, I mean, it's a lot, right? But if you accomplish all that, you're not yet the exemplary Jew. You've just accomplished the prerequisites to grow from there into the light that you're supposed to be. And so too, the land of Israel. So we have the land, but here it's saying that beauty and naturalness, environment, is a prerequisite for the development. So it really feeds into, let's just say, our, around this table, shared American sensibility or Western sensibility of art and music and poetry being things that enable us to seek higher levels, not as an end in itself, which is the Yavan, the Greek ideal, right? So we say that that Yavan will live in the tents of shame. So we are shame, right? And if you think about shame, Ham and Yafet, Yafet's child is Yavan. Shame, Ham, and Yafet, the three sons of Noah, right, in their blessings and curses. So Yafet from Yafa, beauty, is about beauty and about beauty as a destination, not as a prerequisite. That eventually he's supposed to live in the tents of shame. That our goal is the intellectual and the spiritual, but that we need, and some people will say we don't want, but we need, and that's what this is saying, we need the physical beauty in order to achieve that level. It does inspire the soul to seek further. You can only do that once you have a full belly and a non-leaking roof and, right, clothes that keep you warm. So once you have the basics, you can then seek further. So in this country, that's why we have art installations. I still don't know why we have the blue horse.
But some people believe.
Really has to go. I'm sorry, but I like the bear peering into the building downtown. Like, you know, what is the art that we have? But it is about ennobling. It is about thinking about different things or going outside of the basic need, and we want to go beyond that. So it's really just a stepping stone. But that's what it's saying here, is that the importance of cleanliness, beauty, and naturalness of environment for a balanced development of the Torah personality is essential. That's why the city has to be this way. The enjoyment of the beauties of nature, the contemplation of flower-clad meadows, lofty mountains, and majestically flowing rivers are essential to spiritual development. Consistent with this, we read in the Torah something which is probably the earliest recorded example of town planning legislation. The 48 cities, which are allocated to the tribe of Levi, are to have a belt of land 1,000 cubits wide all around the city, reserved as a migrash, open space. In addition, there are to be an additional 2,000 cubits all around for agricultural use. The function of the migrash is to be an amenity to the city. No building and no planting of vineyards, etc., is to be allowed there. We recognize in this the 20th century town planning concept of the green belt, whose purpose is to allow city people to enjoy the fresh air of the countryside. The oral law tells us that these regulations applied not only to the Levitical cities, but by analogy to all the cities of Israel. Here we have, 3,500 years ago, an unparalleled awareness of the importance of the physical environment, which we would do well to take to heart. So that is Aryeh Carmel. He also, just so you know, not only translated Rav Hirsch's works, but also Rav Dessler's works. He's the translator of Strive for Truth. So he's a solid Torah personality to learn from. Okay, so with that, now let's look at this mitzvah, 342, not to alter the open land around the Levites' cities or their fields. Now you know what that is, right? Not to change the open land about the cities of the Levites and their fields. In other words, a city should not be turned into open land, nor open land into a city. Neither should a field be made open land, nor open land made a field. So those three levels, city, open land, and fields, have to remain what they are.
I'm sorry. So the green space around the city, the agricultural land, and what is the field?
The city itself.
Right, so it's city, green belt, agricultural space. And those three layers have to remain unchanged as layers. They have to be managed. I don't know how it works with urban sprawl. You know, when the city's spread far and wide, how does that work? I don't know. And I guess that's what he's saying, is he doesn't really know. Because, you know, it's a different world today than it was then, as we'll see in the next mitzvah also, but we're not going to get there yet. Where the outskirts used to be.
Yeah, exactly.
Just like the airport. And Stapleton, I'm sure, at some point was on the outskirts of the city.
Totally.
Right? And now it's in the middle. And that's why they built this new airport in Kansas.
Right.
Because
and one of
they
these
never
days,
want the city right. to get that far, I think. I mean, it's like so far. How could the city ever get there? But maybe it will. And someday maybe it will be the heart of the city and they'll have to build a new airport somewhere actually, out of nowhere. We'll have hovercraft by then or something.
Hopefully.
Or we'll just be doing what they did in Star Trek, you know.
Just time travel, booths, time
go
travel.
Go to the booths and
Beam me up.
And beam me up, yeah. Beam me around. It just makes me nervous about reconfiguring, like if you scramble with somebody.
I know, yeah. Yeah.
But I guess we don't have to really worry about it yet. Nobody's offering us a trial.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Okay, so the injunction is to not change these arrangements ever. Hence it was stated, but the fields of the open land about their cities may not be sold, for so is the interpretation given about this reference to selling, they may not be altered. For this could not mean actual selling, since it is written, the Levites have a perpetual right of redemption, meaning if they have the perpetual right of redemption, they do have a right to sell and then redeem. So it has to mean they can't change it rather than they can't sell it. At the root of the purpose lies the reasons that the cities of the Levites were prepared for the... Okay, so this is very important philosophy here, so listen to this carefully, okay? At the root of the precept lies the reason that the cities of the Levites were prepared for the needs of all the other tribes. Right, so these are Levitical cities, but they're for everyone. How? For this was the tribe chosen for the service of the eternal Lord, and their entire occupation was with wisdom, since they were not burdened with affairs of agricultural labor like the other tribes of Israel. Of them it was said, they shall teach Jacob thy ordinances and Israel thy law. And because of the fact that there was wisdom among them, all the Israelites always had dealings with them, apart from the fact that among their cities were the cities of refuge for an inadvertent killer. As a result, the eyes of Israel were on their cities, of all Israel were on their cities, for a man never knows what a day may bring forth. It's a quote from Proverbs. So the idea is that the Levites are the wise ones. Levites include the Kohanim, right? So the Levitical tribe includes a subset of Kohanim. That's not a tribe, but a subset of the Levites, right? So it's that group that are the teachers of Israel. And so if you think about it, since the other 11 tribes had their land, and really it was the other, I think basically we went with the other 9, because 2 had it outside the land of Israel. 10 had it inside the land of Israel, but it was really only 9 because the Levites were one of the Eretz Israeli tribes, but they didn't have land, right? So the other 10 tribes, the other 9 tribes, had their land, and from their land they gave their tithes so that all the food... So it's interesting that when you give the tithe, right, it's only after you've harvested everything, so that it has to come from the 100%. Meaning that 100% of your labor in the planting and the weeding and the everything that you do to bring that crop to your to bring it to fruition, right? To bring it to harvest, everything really feeds the Levites. And then when you take off what you're giving to them, you're still eating from your efforts to feed them. If you think about it, right? Because you had to do all that in order to give them the tithe, which means that all of your efforts are consecrated by that feeding, by that tithing, when you give it to them. So that there is that symbiotic relationship of everything that I do is for the sake of holiness, even what just what I eat, because I've sanctified it now through spending all my efforts in raising crop, that some of which will go to the Levium. If you would say, this 10% of my field is for the Levitical tithe and the rest is for me, you can't do that, first of all. But if you would do that, then 90% of your work wouldn't be sanctified because it would just be to feed you, right? So this way, 100% of your work is sanctified because it's only at the end that you can take off the top and give it to the Levium. And then the Levium are sustained by that, and then all of their wisdom is to feed into the nation so that we do have that symbiotic relationship. I did recently learn from Eliyahu Kitov's book, The Jew in His Home, which until, I'm not sure if they still do, but for sure for a long time, the state of Israel gave to every bride and groom, because it was just the basic book on how to set up a Jewish home and shalom bayit. So in that book, it talks about challah in the context of this tithing, and that challah is even more sanctified than the tithes, because it was extended to outside the boundaries of Israel and extended to past temple times. So that, outside agriculture, that's what it is. Because it's not temple times now, but still the tithes apply in the land of Israel. But challah really technically should only apply in the land of Israel, and only when a Kohen can come into your home and get it. You actually get to pick the Kohen. You don't have to, it can't be
just somebody who passed.
It doesn't have to be somebody who's passing by, it doesn't have to be a Kohen who says, I'm hungry. It can be the Kohen you like, right? So that you do create a relationship with the teacher, so that they have to create a relationship with you. And they come into your home to get it. You don't bring it to them. So that when they come into your home, you have a private few moments with the Torah teacher, and you can show them the appliance. You're not sure if it's halachic, or ask them a question that you want to ask in private, or whatever it is. Without going to them, they come to you. So that's how challah is supposed to work. But since we have challah still today outside the land, when we keep challah, not only are we... Oh, there's two things about it. Not only are we... during temple times, not only are we feeding the Levim and the Kohanim through our work, but today when we keep it, it is a remembrance to keep us going until the Geula, till the redemption, because it was established that we should keep it even outside the land of Israel, even not in temple times, even when there's no agriculture in Israel, so that it would be a placeholder. So that when the Geula comes, people shouldn't say, well, yesterday I didn't have to give challah. How come today I have to give challah? So we all give challah all the time to keep us in practice, so we'll be totally ready for it. So that's number one. But number two, it's a rabbinic decree. So it's a remembrance of the biblical decree, but it's a rabbinic decree, which means we're keeping biblical and rabbinic law when we take challah and anticipating the Geula. So we have three big things going on whenever we take challah, because we are keeping a place for the Geula to come and all that kick back in. Yeah.
So, question. How is it done technically? When you bake challah, you just take a small portion, right? In the land of Israel, when Kohen comes, what do you give? So you bake a whole challah?
It still only has to be a small piece, but I think if you would like that Kohen that you're inviting into your home, you
would give
probably
him a whole
bake
one.
Loaf. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, like probably a little small piece.
I mean, they're going to a lot of different houses, so you don't have to give them a whole, like,
big,
you know,
one.
Yeah, you could give them a nice, you know, a challah like that you're taking out from your baking, or, you know, because they're going to different places, so.
Well, what about the showbreads? I thought that was all part of the...
That's for the ones who are serving in the temple.
Oh, these are the ones
that are just living in the...
Right.
Okay.
So not on temple duty, but they're still on Jew duty, right? Because their job is to still teach Torah.
So this agricultural part that we're talking about, if the Levi'im aren't doing agriculture, who's taking care of that?
That's a good question. I mean, the answer to that. That's an excellent question. It's a Levitical city.
Right. So, I mean, they're in the city and they can enjoy the green
space. I guess there's
not
Levium who live in the Levitical cities. Certainly in the refuge cities.
Yeah. Well, for sure.
For sure in the refuge cities, because that would be...
So I guess that's right. So I guess even the cities that have been to them, 100% of the people that live there are probably others, and they would be responsible. That makes sense.
And it may possibly be Levites who do take care
of it. I mean, it's just interesting that this is a Levitical city with the green belt, so that all that's
works,
good.
Right.
And then we have the part on the outside, which also logically is good because, you know, food is grown there,
the city,
and you know, so it all makes sense. But it just sort of like,
but who runs that? And then if it's run by Levites, I wonder what their chiyuv is for tithing. It would be a further question. Right. Interesting questions, which I don't know the answer to, but they are interesting. So I'll refer you to page 429 where it says.
Go check it out.
Get smart.
Harder to check things out that aren't so applicable today.
Right. But, I mean, we could check it out. I'm sure there's somebody who knows that answer. Just, I don't. I didn't think of that question. It's an excellent question. But I do want to point out this also on the bottom of page 429, the last paragraph, because we see that it is the tribe of Levi who is set aside, and it's really God who is their inheritance, but that other people can do that too, even if they're not Levium. Right, so now Rambam of Blessed Memory wrote about this precept. So there's two things here. Right, I'll read these two paragraphs. Why did the tribe of Levi not attain an inheritance of territory in the land of Israel and a share of its booty along with its brothers, the other tribes? Because it was set apart to worship the eternal Lord and serve him and to teach his upright ways. Therefore, they were separated from the ways of the world. They would neither engage in war like the other Israelites, nor receive tribal territory, nor would they gain anything for themselves by their own physical prowess, but would only be the legion of the Lord, as it is stated, let the Lord bless his legion, etc., and give them the right to his portion, as it is stated, I am your portion and your inheritance. So it's supposed to be God that's their inheritance, and his Torah that's their inheritance, not the physical land, but spirituality instead. That being said, right, so that when we do our agricultural stuff, we are feeding into that, and they teach us. However, Rambam continues. Not the tribe of Levi alone is included in this, but any and every man among those, I'll say person, among those who have come into the world whose spirit moves him to set himself apart and stand before the Lord to serve him, to know his upright and righteous ways and to teach them to others. So it's two, to know them and to teach them. So he removes from about his neck the yoke of many schemes that people seek out. Then he thus becomes consecrated to be the holiest of the holy. The Lord will be his inheritance forever and ever, and he will attain in this world a measure that will suffice for him, just as the tribe of Levi attained it. So David said, "The Lord is the portion of my allotment and my cup. Thou dost sustain my lot." Now, here's an important piece of information, okay? If you look at number 8, note number 8, right, which is on the world, on the words, and he will attain in this world a measure that will suffice for him. He will attain in this world a measure that will suffice for him.
He'll work,
right? So that he will earn an adequate living and will not become a public charge or burden. So it's interesting to think about if a non-Levi wants to become a servant of God to learn his Torah and teach it and therefore be relieved from worldly burdens, they're not supposed to become a burden on the people. They're supposed to somehow...
So they still have to earn their keep.
Well, they have to earn it somehow, but it's not just that. It's supposed to be that God will give it to them. So we talked about different ways of that happening, right? So one way of it happening is that somehow they'll get more money, and another way is somehow things will cost less for them.
Or would it be also that they were satisfied with less?
And also satisfied. There's many different ways. So I'll just give you a for instance, right? So we literally had, and I'm not putting myself in this category, but I'm just showing you one way that things can cost less, right? So we literally had, our roof was leaking and literally raining like into the house, right? And we couldn't afford a new roof. And we had different people come over and say, you know, hail damage, we'll check your roof. And those different people went up on our roof and they're all about selling a new roof. And they would come down and say, sorry, you don't qualify. And these are people who are like, really want you to qualify.
Right.
They really want your business, right? So I'm thinking, oh, we have to buy a new roof. We have a big roof. It's going to be like $15,000.
It's very expensive.
New roofs are
very expensive.
And then there was like a salary dispute where there was some kind of concern with my salary. In Israel, when they say a salary, they mean gross. But in America, they mean net. And in America, when you hear it, you hear gross, right? So there was some dispute. And so they were saying, you're probably entitled to some back pay. And it might be around $20,000. I'm thinking, that's a roof. And I need an update in my car. My car is like an older car. And I'm thinking, roof car. Okay, I need that. And then they said, well, really, that money's been spent. We don't have it. So you're probably not going to get it. And I'm going, oh, there goes my roof. And there goes my car. Then somebody else came and checked out our roof and said, for sure you have hail damage. And they called our insurance company, and they absolutely covered the whole thing. And so now we have a brand new roof, right? And my in-laws came for Pesach, and they said, you really need a new car. And now I have a new car. And I didn't get the back pay, right? So sometimes things can cost you less, and you get what you need, and you, like you could, it could be because you earned it could be because you were blessed with it, it could be, like, who knows how different things, could be because you didn't need it. I was happy driving my 10-year-old Subaru. I got a big dent Pesach time. On the ice, as one of my kids drove to the supermarket, spun around, smacked another car who drove off. And, right, so that, like, really, like, pointed out the car to my in-laws, who really said, you know what, it's time. But, like, the point is, there's different ways for things can cost less. Like, I have a Rebbetzin who went to the dentist, one of my, you know, many. She went to the dentist, and as they were talking, and she had a bunch of work, and as they were talking, he found out she's a Rebbetzin on a campus, and he comped her on the whole thing, right? A few $1,000 worth of work. So it can happen that things cost less without you seeking tzedakah. Right? That things can work that way.
Mostly it works the other way.
It can work the opposite too. It can work the opposite too. But what I'm saying is it can work both ways. You know, where because somebody cheated on whatever, and I'm not saying people cheat, but, you know, like that, if somebody does, they don't get that money. You can't cheat money out of God. So then things cost more. Right? Or because of, so there's different factors. Things can cost you less. Or somebody could have come along and said, I know how to fix roofs. We did have some Mexican guy who came and went up on the roof and said, I see your spots, I'll put tar in it.
Uh-huh.
Did not help. Right, so I was thinking, okay, $57, you know, like, that's his 2 hours of labor and the bucket of tar, it's going to be fixed. We'll save the 15. No, it didn't work. But it could have, that's the point, is it could have worked. So depending on what, you know, different things and how God decides to run your money, it's all in the hands of Hashem. It really is, right? You get decided at Rosh Hashanah what you get, and if you try to get more, you don't get it, and if you, somebody thinks they can steal it from you, they can't take it away from you. That's the point. So if somebody will back into your car and then drive off, right, and you're thinking, oh, now I have to fix it on my own, it's $1,500 out of my money. It's not really. Nobody can steal from you what's really yours. It can't be taken away from you. You'll get it back somewhere else, right? You won't have a root canal that you're supposed to have because you can't have the $1,500 taken away from you. You can't. Hashem decides your money, right? So you can't have it stolen, really. And you can't steal. It's not possible. You can't get more than you're supposed to get, and you can't lose more than you're supposed to lose. Hashem runs the world. There's just different ways for it to run. So that's what it's saying here, is that if somebody chooses to become a Torah learner and teacher, then somehow God's going to figure it out that he will be their inheritance forever, and he will attain in this world a measure that will suffice for him. Yes, he has to lower his expectations, right? Yes, he has to, there's different ways, but he'll get fed the right way without having to become a public charge or burden. That's what it's supposed to be. So with that, I don't even know like what the story is with American, you know, we have so much, many people learn Torah based on American gifts, and I just don't know where we hold with that. Is that burden or is that not burden? Is that fair? Is that not fair? I think different people hold different ways on that stuff. You know. Anyway, with that, as I was learning this, I was humming this song, right? And I thought it's so interesting as I was just humming, and then I realized the song that I'm humming is Eretz Yisrael Yafah, right? Beautiful land of Israel. And so I wish I could play it. We want to look it up on our phones, but I'll just read you part of it. I'll first read the verse of it, right? So the third paragraph down, where it says Pizmon. Pizmon means chorus, right? So the chorus is Eretz Yisrael Yafa, Eretz Yisrael Parachat, At Yoshvaba Vitzofa, At Sofaba Vizorachat. So I'm not sure if I get all the words, but it's a beautiful land of Israel. The land of Israel is sprouting, blossoming. You sit in it and gaze. You gaze in it and shine. Right? That's my understanding of the words, right? But you might recognize, I'll sing you the verse. Eretz Yisrael Yafa, Eretz Yisrael Parachat, At Yoshva Ba Vitzofa, At Sofa Ba Vizorachat. Do you recognize that? Na 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 na. Right, so, but the verses are nice. I listened to it on YouTube. You can take it home and work on the translation if you want. It's really lovely. A young daughter who's beautiful to look at, we have in the land of Israel. And Yel, so first it's talking about the good girl and then the good boy. But Yel Tov Yerushalayim, that's what we get to see. So a good, we have the beautiful daughters and we have the good son of Jerusalem. V'Torah Ora Kazu Yeshlanu. We have the Torah of light. This is not a religious song, right? This is a regular, secular poet writing this, which I think is so interesting. Actually, I don't know if it was a secular poet, but think about the land of Israel at the early time, and think about what Ben-Gurion said, right? Ben-Gurion, who wanted to create a secular society and was so disappointed after he succeeded, when he said, ach, I wanted a land of apikorsim, and what I got was a land of amaratzim, right? I wanted people who reject Torah, and what I got was people who are ignorant of Torah. But this is written back in the day when people knew so much Torah,
I think.
Ben-Gurion. And they knew so much Torah, it was just woven into their
words. I was going to say, I think that it was, he was in such a different time.
Such a different time, but that's what he was seeking, though. He was seeking this. That's why I want to bring this as an example. He was seeking this, where people got it. Even if they didn't keep it, they knew how beautiful our heritage is and how it's woven together. Even if that, and that's what he wanted, was people who had this and maybe didn't keep it.
Just inside.
But,
it was inside.
Yeah, but it was inside. But you can't get it inside without. But just listen to the words here. The Torah Ora Kazu Yeshlanu. We have this Torah of light. V'gam Haggadah u'Megillah, and the Haggadah and the Megillah. V'Elohim Echad Shelanu v'Kol Chatan v'Kol Kala. Right? So this is what we have. We have this Torah of light. We have this one God. We have the Haggadah. We have the Megillah. And the voice of the Chasan and the Kala. That's what we have. Right? And the verse underneath the chorus. Lanu Yesh Achai Harim Alafim. We have, my brother, the thousands of mountains. Bam Navu Raglei Hamevaser. That's where dwell the feet of our message sender. V'gam malach min ha-shamayim, and also the angel from heaven. Sha'at nafshenu hu shomer. She'et nafshenu hu shomer. That our soul he does guard. And it talks about just the different types of people in the land of Israel and the different flowers in the land of Israel and the different just things in the land of Israel. In the last verse, on the second page, Bekachol Lavan Monef Hadegel, in blue and white the flag waves. Yerushalayim Kol Shirai, Vili Yerushalayim Kol Shirai, and to Jerusalem are all my songs. Anachnu Shuv Olim LaRegel, we return to go up on foot. Hoy Shiri Am Yisrael Chai, and this is my song, the nation of Israel lives. It's such a beautiful song. So you take the words and listen to it on YouTube. I put on your paper the link so you can type it in, or you can just type in the words Eretz Yisrael Yafa song, and you'll probably find it. But it's just nice to listen to and hear. But I was what excited me is that I was humming it while I was reading it, and I don't know if it's just me, but sometimes I do seek as a convert like little points of that it's fully clicked, you know, an acculturation, which I do find, I think I've mentioned before, you know, when I cook way too much food for people coming over, I know that I'm definitely Jewish. Or when I think that, you know, if my husband's an hour late and he must surely be dead on the side of a highway and I just don't know yet, and I know I'm truly Jewish.
So this is yet another example.
This is yet another example, humming a song that's totally appropriate, Eretz Yisrael, and plus an old one. You know, like, it was just so nice to know, like, to feel that sense of acculturation and belonging. Like, I know the song, and it fits in with the mitzvah, and it really made me just feel so good to be Jewish. But it was like one of those spiritual moments for me that I wanted to share. Just like all the, and then the song is so beautiful, you know, and just the feeling of the sense of connection. Even though when I listen to it, it's men and women singing together, halachic problems, blah blah blah. But I was thinking, here is our nation. And this is what we sing. Even men and women singing together, this is what we sing. Am Yisrael Chai. Here we are. It's so special. So,
thank you for sharing.
So, okay, with that, we have a few more minutes.
And this is another really long one.
This is very long, and I don't know if we should finish it now.
Long.
It's very, very long.
It's very important.
It is very important.
Maybe we should just not do it.
We have 10 minutes to start it. Yeah, so let's start it as a concept, and hopefully I'll figure out the one I was trying to figure out in the car. Like, how did that work? But maybe you'll help me if I don't get it. Okay. So here is the concept. The prohibition against lending at interest. Shelo lehalvot beribit liYisrael. So we're not allowed to lend to a Jew at interest. We are allowed to lend to non-Jews at interest. But interest, so what does that mean? Ribit, ribis, as they say in English. But ribit. So we're not allowed to use ribit, and there's two different words. Neshech is also a word, not one that we use familiarly in English, but you should just know the word. And it's at the end of that first line of the mitzvah in Hebrew, if you want to see it, written in Hebrew, neshech. Neshech and ribit are the same. They're used interchangeably, as he explains here. You will not find one without the other, but why does it use both? In order to really make sure that it sounds like two negative precepts, to increase the injunctions against it, this is a really, really big one. That's what he's saying. It's really big. You cannot charge interest, you cannot lend at interest, and it has very broad implications. So I'll give you an example of a very broad implication. We all know about money, even though it may be difficult, but we all know clearly you can't give a loan and charge interest on that. We'll look at a business application, but you can't do that, right? So if somebody says, can I borrow $100? They can't give you back $110. They can't give you back $100 and a penny. So now the question is, they go shopping at Costco for you, right? It was $39.87. Can they give you $40? You know, it's just like such a hassle for you to like pick through and they just say whatever. Is that interest? Did you lend them money? And if they give you two $20 bills to cover that with the few cents change, is that returning a loan at interest? That's a question, and we're careful not to do that. So when some people will not, and they will return every penny or write a check for the exact amount because they want to make sure they don't transgress on this. Sometimes you see it as a loan, sometimes you don't see it as a loan, but technically that would be a loan if you're shopping for somebody and you lay out the money and then they pay you back, so they can't pay you back with interest. What about when you borrow somebody's car? You borrow their car, the tank is a quarter full, right? You drive, you put some gas in it, Let's say the tank is 3/4 full. You borrow the car, it's 3/4 full. You drive around, right? You use a half a tank. You fill it to the top and return it to them. Because that's the nice thing to do. You borrow their car, you fill the tank, right? You don't return it to 3/4, you fill it. Is that interest? It's a question if that's interest, right? Because you borrowed their thing and now you're returning it better.
Isn't it there are lots of things, for instance, on Shabbos, okay? If separation, borer, okay? Mm-hmm. Wash, we're not separating. In this case, it's not a great example because it's not, the law is really separating good from bad.
Right.
But
well, separating altogether. You learn that it's good from bad, right? In your closet, it can be a problem to take out what you want to wear from what you don't want to wear.
Right, but we understand lots of those things, like washing or taking out what you want to wear or don't want to wear. But that's not what you're doing. What you're doing is washing your apple.
Right.
Or what you're doing is getting dressed.
Right.
Okay? It's different than, like, I have M&Ms and peanuts and bowl and I'm pushing through because I want
only
service.
Want the,
that's a
right.
little bit different. Okay.
Right.
So wouldn't it be, in this case, the same sort of construct to understand I borrowed someone's car, I fill it up, they lent me their car, it took mile, you know, it wore wear and tear, or it was their wagon, and I fed their horse extra, okay?
Right.
Couldn't it be understood in that context of, it's not about the interest,
right.
It's about
so
the chesed,
right.
Returned.
So it's really a question.
But it becomes the other person's problem, right? Because it looks like that other person
has received the interest.
Right, so you're not permitted to pay it, or charge it.
Okay.
You're not permitted to pay it.
So
or charge
it's on both people.
It's on both.
She's
right.
It's
right.
On the person who does it and the one who receives
so you
it.
You can't overpay.
Right.
Either.
You're not permitted. Right. This is very long, so we're not going to finish the whole thing. But let's just look at Let's see if we can look at the end where it says to whom it applies. Let's see.
But this seems like, I don't know.
It's very tricky. Let's look at the three.
Like everything, you know, there are so many little things that we do we don't even think.
I know.
About.
So that's why this will not be practical halacha. This will just be question mark raising because I'm not equipped to teach the practical halacha on interest. There's books on it and rabbis to go to ask these questions. And I think it would be interesting. So I'll try to ask some questions and we can finish this mitzvah next time. But we definitely need to ask some of those because the three types of interest that it talks about. That's why I wrote three on your list here.
Wait, can I say?
Mm-hmm.
But when you're saying that, like the whole idea of all of that, we don't even think about it, is
right.
Is what we're supposed to be thinking about.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right.
I'm speaking for myself.
Right.
I just don't think. Yes.
Right, so we have
well,
to learn
Well, not
more.
In that context. I mean, I think...
That's why we just want to raise
so what are the three types?
So the three types are the straight up, I'm lending you money and you're paying me at interest, right? That's completely us, or we all recognize that. And there's many different ways to accomplish that, but it's not okay, right? However you try to arrange it, it's not okay. So you can't say, I'll give you 100 and you'll give me back 120 in a year. Like the cost that you're purchasing this from me for 120, you can't say it that
right.
way. It's interest, right? So straight up money. The second type is gifts, right?
That's where I was going.
I try to butter
in my head.
Yeah, I try to butter you up for a loan. I give you gifts before or I give you
or
gifts
vice versa.
After.
Yeah, I was
right.
Gonna,
so
I
gifts
was,
before
yeah.
or gifts after can count as interest, even if it's not about the loan. I want to borrow your car, right? And I like to do that regularly. I want that loan from you. So I make sure, and I'm not saying this is us or I don't know, I have to check. I make sure I return it clean. I take it to the car wash. Right, and when you get it back, so you love lending to me. Is that a problem? I don't know the answer.
But that implies a motive in giving the gift.
Right.
Even a subconscious motive. What mm-hmm. if there isn't that motive at all, but it's just the way the person is?
Right.
Those two things even seem different.
Because this is type two, is gifts, before and after. Let's see if I could find that. Let's see.
I mean, because that sort of seems, you know, if you do it with the intent of encouraging or hoping that they'll do it again or whatever, as opposed to just because that's the kind of person you are.
Right.
Not me. I'm not speaking personally.
I had your kid for play date and I fed him. What is that? Like?
Right. Let him go hungry. Let him go
right.
hungry.
Right. Well, so that's a different kind of thing. You're, right. But there are all these questions. Like, what can
you...
you
see that just raised your consciousness. Already.
That's well, but then, you know,
then you'll drive yourself crazy. Right.
Right.
I can't feed you because.
No, so we do actually have to learn those halachas. Like, well, how does it work? Because it does have to do with if you borrow an animal and feeding the animal, Or if you, if somebody, so here's just an interesting question to raise because of that I saw in the language. Let's say I want to borrow $100,000, right? So you give me as collateral your house in the mountains, right?
Can you use it?
I can use it, but let's say I rent it out, right? Do I get to keep that money, or is that money interest, right? So I do get to vacation there while I have...
Yourself.
I think so. I'm pretty sure I get to. Well, so these are all questions.
No.
Not halacha l'maisa here. But there is a problem to eat from the fruits, right? That's interest. Now, it says eat from the fruits, which made me think about something that we say every day about eating from the fruits. What do we say every day?
The blessing? You're talking about the blessing over a fruit?
No, I'm talking about the blessing over the Torah, right? These are the things from which we eat the fruits in this world, and the Keren Kayemet remains for us in the next world, right? So that's Hashnasat Kala, right? It's taking care of the bride, it's taking a guest, it's tending to the sick, it's burying the dead, right? And arriving at the study hall early, right?
Right.
And all these things are
and
without
and prayer.
Compensation.
Right.
All these things have no shi'ur, not without compensation.
They do have compensation.
Well, all of them have no fixed amount.
Yeah.
So there's no minimum
in
that you have
world,
to do that, no maximum that you have
time.
To do that. No, so those are all mitzvot, that there's no minimum and maximum amount that you have to do them.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Okay.
So when can you say, I fulfilled the mitzvah of visiting the sick?
Never.
There's no limit that says I did it.
Right, you just something
and
you do.
And when do you say I have transgressed by not visiting the sick? There's no minimum. I mean, I guess if you never visited anybody ever, by the time you die, so that could be a problem. But when do you say I didn't do enough, and when do you say I did do enough? There's no shi'ur, right? So that's what we say. There's no shi'ur. However, we do eat the fruits in this world, and the how do you say Keren Kayemet? And the principle is remains for us in the next world. So we get the. So it's interesting. We get the interest. That's what it's saying. Because peroteum is the interest, right? We're allowed to eat the interest. So I was just thinking, you know, and again, didn't really think this through, but just struck me as I'm reading this, right, that we do, God pays us.
There are some things,
interest.
There are some things that we get.
So we're allowed to have the interest of what God pays us, but we're not allowed to lend or borrow an interest.
Fellow
man. Right, from our fellow Jew. We are allowed, it's interesting that we are allowed with Christians. Muslims also have a thing about not lending an interest to each other. I don't know if Christians have that within... They don't have law. Christians don't have law. Muslims have law. Jews have law. Christians have practices. I don't think that... And I don't know if there are certain Christian sects that have a law that applies to them. So I don't know if it's a custom or a practice not to lend an interest or however.
But there must be something, because that's why they had the Jews as moneylenders. Because they couldn't charge,
they couldn't charge interest,
which is why they set up the Jews as moneylenders.
I think the Jews started this because they couldn't do anything.
I think there's something else though.
Because, you know, the whole idea with the blood libel and Shylock and the whole caricature.
So much. Well, many times, because Jews were moneylenders, because they could, that was a way that they could make money, they were often exiled to not have to pay back debt.
Right, exactly.
So they lent money
to the crown,
it was.
When they got too far into debt, they just said kick them all out.
Right. Right.
It happened repeatedly.
Yeah. So it is.
The Jews got in Poland in whatever Middle Ages because they were invited there as bankers.
Right.
Polish kings saw how prosperous Germany was.
Right.
They wanted the same kind of thing, and they knew the Jews could.
And I think that happened.
They still kick them out.
And that happened more than once,
right.
too.
Yeah, the Turks also invited the Jews. At the Spanish expulsion, the Turks invited the Jews and said, please, come live here. We want you.
Yeah.
And that's why, I mean, that's why the Greeks and Turks speak Ladino, is because they came from Spain at the time. And that era is just ending today. I mean, just fizzling out. The last Jews are leaving. It's interesting to see. And the last Latino is being forgotten, unfortunately, or dying out. Because there is no more. I think one of the definitions of an alive language is that school is taught in that language. Mm. Not that the language is taught in school, but that school is taught in that language. So Yiddish, still alive. School is taught to children in Yiddish. Right, but Ladino, no. So you only have, I'd say, like 60 pluses, age 60 plus, who still speak it fluently, and 40-year-olds, their kids, who, like we know some Yiddish, know some Ladino, you know, the phrases, and they recognize it, and their kids barely know anything. So there's not the phrases that are used anymore. Like we might say, you know, don't hack me a chinek, right, which harkens to Yiddish, and we might even say it in Yiddish, right, but our kids don't. They don't know that
phrase.
It's not a phrase that they would use, right? So the same thing in Ladino today. It is dying, but as a language. And that was caused by Ataturk, who legislated, in order to bring Turkey into the modern world, who legislated that all school must be taught in Turkish. And that was the death knell for Ladino as a language, because that's where school was taught in Ladino until he legislated that. Anyway, yeah, the Jews do bring blessing.
What about South America? Still do speak Ladino there.
No, because they're Ashkenazic.
It was never a language there.
Right. Because it was Ashkenazim, Yiddish speakers, who went to South America. So the Spanish that they learned is the Spanish of the country. They didn't make it into Judeo-Spanish. Whereas the Jews in Spain spoke a Judeo-Spanish, like the Jews in Germany spoke a Judeo-German.
Right, but that's why Latin America speaks Spanish, because it was the Spanish...
But it wasn't the same group. You're right. The Spaniards went to South America. That's why they speak Spanish and not Indian languages, right? But the Jews who went to South America were from Ashkenazic.
They didn't go with conquistadors. They were
generally not.
There were some Jews, but that's not the Jewish communities. The Jewish communities are mostly. I mean, I think the strength of the Jewish communities.
I think after the expulsion from Spain,
Some went. But you don't see, like, the Greeks and the Turkish Jews in Mexico, is my experience anyway, when I went to Mexico, the ones who speak Ladino are the Turks. And I think also, here's another piece. If you go, that I did speak to the young Turkish rabbi, the son of the Turkish rabbi in the shul in Mexico City, so I asked him about his Ladino. He doesn't have it. Why? Because he speaks Spanish. Right, so the only way Ladino can survive is if you're in a culture that it's the other language and it doesn't blend. That was the problem, now I remember, right? So if you're speaking Ladino, Judeo-Spanish, and you move to a Spanish-speaking country, you're going to blend into their Spanish rather than maintain your Judeo-Spanish. That's what happened when they left. So while the Judeo-Spanish was developed in a Spanish-speaking country, it was maintained in Turkey and Greece where it was the Jewish language. Whereas once they went to the other Spanish-speaking countries, they blended. Those Jews assimilated. So there is still a little bit of Ladino left over by the older generation.
Right, that's the older generation.
But only by the older generation. So the young, fully Spanish-speaking rabbi in his 30s does not. I mean, he knows a few prayers in Ladino, but he doesn't speak Ladino. He just recognizes it from his parents because his Spanish is too fluent.
Like Yiddish and Russian, you can't now find people who speak Yiddish still. The people who were would be in their hundreds now, my grandparents.
Right, right. Those are the ones. Right, exactly. Yeah.
Well, if you all want Ladino, 4 questions for next year.
Yeah.
My father has them.
Oh yeah, Ladino.
Yeah. No.
We have the Echad Miyudea.
It's
Ladino. Echad Miyudea.
I think we shared that, didn't
Maybe.
We?
Maybe. 5 libros de la ley, 4 lados de Israel, 6 calle Arachel, 3 maestros padres son.
Yes.
Dos Moshe Yaron, uno so creador. Powerful Baruch Shalom. Yeah.
Hello. Stephen Comer, Elisa Bulo.
Okay, let me just stop.
Esther.